Wait, hang on. Okay, no, Sean, stop. Yeah, stop. Okay, before we jump into the podcast, I wanted to talk to our listeners about something. Now, in this episode, we are going to be talking a lot about things that you can do to help us out at Deemable Tech. One, of course, subscribe to the show. The more subscribers we have, the higher we're listed in iTunes, and more people will find out about our show and start listening. Also, if you haven't already, put in a review on iTunes. Those really help out a lot. The more stars you give us, the higher we get ranked. And the more reviews we have, the higher we get ranked. So those really help us out. Of course, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Those all help to raise the promotion of our show so that other people find out about us. And tell your friends and family about us so they hear the show too. But the goal of our show is to be a public radio show. That is why we do this. We are so fortunate that WJCT lets us use their studios to produce this show, but we're not on the radio yet. We have a small segment that we do on Morning Edition here in Jacksonville on WJCT, but we really want this show to be a public radio station. So here's how you can help us with that. If you like Deemable Tech, if you love listening to our show, will you call your public radio station and ask them to play Deemable Tech? Now, most likely they're going to be like, what's Deemable Tech? I've never heard of that. Well, you can tell them to go to Deemable.com and they can hear our show, or they can visit PRX.org, which is the public radio exchange, and they can listen to our produced pieces that have been done so that they can download them and show them on their radio station. And of course, they can contact us. My email address is rayhollister@deemable.com. So call your local public radio station and let them know that you want to hear Deemable Tech on your radio station. If you're here in Jacksonville, of course, that's WJCT 89.9 FM. But if you're out of Jacksonville, call whatever your station is. You can usually find their website. They've got a contact number. And just let them know, hey, there's a show that we love to hear, and we'd like to hear it on your public radio station because it's public radio. You're the public. They do what you want them to do. That's the whole point. So let them know what you're interested in hearing, and hopefully that will be Deemable Tech. Thanks. All right, now let's do the show. Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange, homegrown hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting, on the web at asmallorange.com. From WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech, technology worth talking about and tech help worth listening to.
Got a question about your computer, smartphone, tablet, or the internet? Give us a call at 1-888-972-9868 or send us an email at questions@deemable.com. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about whether you can play 3D Blu-rays on your HD TV and
how to share a Kindle with your significant other, and
how to extend the battery life of your cell phone, and
does Facebook owe you money? But first,
we have a voicemail from a listener. Sean, can you play that for us?
Hey guys, this is Ray from Jacksonville. I was calling because I've noticed that when I try to use Windows 8, the new Windows, it makes me sick to my stomach.
Coincidence.
I really thought Windows 8 was cool when I first read about it and, you know, the tech blogs. And,
yeah, me too.
And heard about it on the tech podcast that I listened to. But after I started playing with it, I realized it was actually making me sick to my stomach, like making me queasy. And it's true when I use Windows Phone or Windows 8 on the desktop or a tablet. So it feels like it's something about the way it moves back and forth and side to side. I thought it was maybe the refresh rate when I noticed it was happening on Windows Phone. Maybe that was, you know, a low refresh rate. But then I saw it on some really nice tablets, and it still made me sick in my stomach. Anyways, I was just wondering if I'm the only one or if I'm not. So let me know. And let me know if you can find out why. Thanks.
Ray, do you know what the problem with radio or podcasting is?
What's that?
Folks at home can't see the way I'm shaking my head at you right now. All right, that guy sounded really familiar, Mr. Hollister.
Well, yeah. You know, we've talked about it on the show briefly several times, and I can never get you to look into it and find out what was causing it. So I figured I'd send in a voicemail, and then maybe I would get an answer.
Well, we do prioritize voicemails over email, so that is actually a good way to make sure that your question gets answered. So what did we find out?
Well, first of all, let me reiterate that I wanted to love Windows 8.
Okay.
I loved the way that Microsoft was using the same design across all of their products, from Windows Phone to Windows 8 on the desktop and laptops, and now tablets, and even how they're bringing it to the Xbox. So it'd be one unified look across all of them.
Sure.
And then I used it. And like I said, Windows Phone came out first, so that's what I tried first. And when I got a little queasy, I just figured it was low refresh rates. That happens on some monitors. With low refresh rates, I'll kind of get, my stomach gets messed up. But then when I tried it on Windows 8 on a desktop, it was way worse. So I did look into it, and here's something humorous. Obviously, the first place I went to look was Google.
Right.
And I typed in Windows 8 made me, and I was about to type in the rest, sick to my stomach, when this popped up in the suggested searches. Windows 8 made me switch to Mac. And that did really make me chuckle.
So Google suggested searches, of course, are based on the most popular searches that other people are doing. So that means that there's quite a few folks out there who are turned off by Windows 8, huh?
Yeah, I took a little detour from what I was supposed to be doing, and I looked at some of the search results for that Windows 8 made me switch to Mac. And it was mostly scathing reviews of Windows 8.
Hmm.
So anyway, back on track, I searched for Windows 8 nausea, and I found out that a lot of people were complaining about the same thing.
Really?
Yeah, it turns out the reason why folks like me feel that way, that we were going to toss our cookies every time we use Windows 8, it's the same reason why we felt that way when we saw the Blair Witch Project or Cloverfield. It's motion sickness.
Hmm.
And it's the way that the start screen slides back and forth from left to right, and the animation that happens when a lot of apps start, where it swipes or glides in from the side. That's what makes folks like me want to grab the Dramamine, just like the jerky handheld camera work in those movies did.
That's really interesting, Ray, but why isn't this a problem for you in iOS or Android? I mean, the apps in the home screen move from left to right on both of them.
That's true. I think the difference is control. See, with Windows Phone and Windows 8, the elements move at different speeds. So, for instance, the title only moves a little bit, while the tiles move a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't move the same distance when you swipe. That was kind of weird when I first saw it, but I didn't think it would bother me. But actually, that's what messes with our equilibrium and starts to make us feel sick. Also, something different about iOS and Android is that the home pages on iOS and Android snap into place after you let go of them. On Windows 8 and Windows Phone, it doesn't. It's going to stay exactly where you left your finger.
Mm.
Or if you lift your finger off while you're swiping, it will maintain that momentum and keep sliding across. So it's like pushing a ball. It just keeps on going.
Right.
Whereas with iOS and Android, it goes, if you move the first page of the home screen halfway and you let go, it's either going to snap back to the first page or snap forward to the next page, depending on which is closer.
Right, it's not going to hang in the middle.
Right. And there's something about that snap that helps to keep us from getting off balance and making our tummy upset. And actually, this makes a lot of sense. Have you ever wondered how ballet dancers and figure skaters can do all their spins without losing their lunch, Tom?
Let's pretend I have, because that will make me sound really intelligent.
Okay. Well, I actually went to an arts high school. I didn't do ballet, but I did learn a little bit about ballet and dance.
I'm sorry. I'm just having a great visual of you doing ballet here. Go ahead.
No, I took dance classes, but never ballet. Well, anyways, they do something called spotting. A ballet dancer will find a spot on the wall or in the audience, something that they can focus on to look at as they begin the spin, and then they keep their eyes on it for as long as possible. Then, when they've turned their body so far that they can't keep their eyes on it anymore because they're not in The Exorcist or, spinning their heads around, they will quickly whip their head around to the other side, find that same spot, and do it again.
Okay, I'm familiar with that motion. Yeah. You see it when the ballerinas are doing it. It's like looking.
Yeah, and they keep doing that over and over again until the spin is over. And figure skaters, they don't do exactly the same thing, but it's similar. So instead of a smooth, endless motion that you would have if you were turning, it's a quick movement and a snap into position.
Mm.
And it's the endless side-to-side motion that Windows 8 has that gives us that makes us feel nauseous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not everyone is sensitive to motion sickness, so this isn't a problem for everybody, but about 33% of folks are. And personally, I'm severely sensitive to motion sickness. I start feeling sick on the bus almost every single day, and my ride is only 2 miles from work.
Wow.
I almost always get sick when I ride in the back seat of a car, and even in the front seat of the car, I'm probably not going to feel great.
So I'm guessing you're probably not a candidate for upgrading to Windows 8, huh?
No, as much as I wanted to, I'm not going to unless I have to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is something that folks can do if they want to upgrade to Windows 8 or if they have to. And we started talking about it last week or the week before. I'm not sure which one it was. But the listener wanted to know how they could get the Windows Start menu back. And that's one option that would help somebody who's dealing with that same motion sickness.
Right.
There are several apps that will bring the Start menu back, and Windows 8 will work similarly to how Windows 7 did, or XP and Vista, all of them. Then you can ditch the Start screen, that menu that slides back and forth, and that'll take care of most of the problems.
Okay, Ray, but if folks have to completely change the way the operating system works just to be able to use it without throwing up, that kind of defeats the whole point. I mean, that doesn't really bode well for the future of the operating system, does it?
No, I mean, it sure doesn't. I mean, again, it's only 33% of the population.
Only one third.
Only one out of every three people. So hopefully Microsoft has some motion sickness sensitive engineers that will work out this problem with a future update to the operating system. And maybe we'll see the page start to snap into position.
Yeah, I really
hope
so.
Maybe that'll solve it. So,
got to bring you back to the Microsoft fold here.
Yep.
Okay, we have another question. Delio asks, how can I erase pictures on my camera roll without eliminating them from my photo albums? I'm using an iPhone 4 with iOS 6.
Interesting. Well, unfortunately, you can't. Every photo that you take with the stock camera app is in your camera roll. If you delete a photo from the camera roll, your picture is deleted from their phone. When you put photos into a photo album, you're not actually moving them. It's not like folders.
Mm-hmm.
You're just sorting them into groups. Photo albums are just selections of pictures, like labels. So if you delete a picture from your photo album, you're just removing it from the album. You're not actually deleting it.
Okay.
It pretty much works the same on every camera app for iOS that I've used. They usually call the camera roll something else, because I think Apple owns that term. They may have it patented.
Yeah.
But they'll call it something else like Filmstrip or Lightroom or something like that.
Right.
But it's always the same concept. All the pictures taken are stored in one place, and they're organized into albums that don't actually move the files. Now, there is an app called Photo Albums Plus on the Cydia store that I have read good reviews for. I haven't used it personally. And the reason why is, of course, because to download any apps from the Cydia store, you have to have your iPhone jailbroken. So, of course, you're at your own risk. I haven't tried that out yet.
Okay. What else have we got?
Well, you know, we don't know everything.
We don't.
Obviously. But we don't even know everything about technology, computers, and gadgets. We just figure it out as we go along. And personally, I've just been really good at faking it all these years.
That's true, Ray. You fake it well.
So, I mean, I'm sure you know everything, but...
Yeah, well, yeah. That's right. No, so, I know a lot, but there's so much out there.
Right.
You know, no one can know everything.
So we got a question that we received by email, and we've been putting it off because we haven't been able to find a good answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to try something new. We want to ask you guys. We want to see what you know, and if you can give this person a better answer than we've been able to come up with. I know we have a pretty sharp audience, and I'll bet at least one of you has a great answer. So we'll call this segment Ask the Audience, or Crowdsourcing an Answer.
Or doing our jobs for us.
You know what? We're really terrible at coming up with names.
We are that. So here's this question. Artist writes, Dear Deemable Duo, which, by the way, I like that name.
Yeah.
I've recently been having some issues scheduling Dungeons & Dragons games due to the busy lives of my fellow dice rollers. I'm sure you find the idea of D&D players having lives as shocking as I do. But regardless, if games are to continue, we need to find some way to around this problem. I was wondering if there was any kind of program that might make it easier to coordinate our schedules. Not necessarily something that will show our full schedules, but something that we could see what free time we have in common or something to that effect. Thank you for whatever insight you might be able to give.
All right, so here's what we want to do. On our website, on the page for this episode, we want you to post your best solution to the problem in the comments. Do you know of a solution that will help artists coordinate the busy social lives of his Dungeon & Dragon players?
If you're listening to the show on the website, just scroll down to the bottom of the page. If you're a podcast app listener, go on over to Deemable.com and tell us what you think. And in advance, we and artists thank you for your help.
All right, well, we have to take a quick break. If you haven't already, show us some love and subscribe to our podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. If you've already subscribed, leave a review for us on iTunes. There's links to the iTunes page and our Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest pages on the right-hand side of our website at Deemable.com. You're listening to Deemable Tech. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Ray Hollister, joined, of course, by my co-host, Tom Braun.
Before we jump back into your questions, would you do us a favor? If you haven't liked us on Facebook or followed us on Twitter, go ahead and do that now. And if you haven't subscribed in iTunes or your favorite podcast app, go ahead and do that now, too. There's links to our iTunes, Facebook, Twitter pages, and more on the right-hand side of our website.
Yeah, and if you like the show, make sure that you share us with your friends on Facebook and Twitter. And if you don't like the show, well, make sure to share us with your enemies.
Oh, yeah.
Either way, that's the only way that folks will find out about our show and subscribe and start listening. We're completely dependent on you because word of mouth is the only marketing we can afford. We love helping folks out with computers and gadgets, but the only way we can do it is if they know that we exist.
True.
So, but some people do know that we exist because we have a question.
Well, actually, Ray, I don't know, before we dive into questions, I don't know if you've heard about this, but recently the editor of Harper's Magazine, which is an old school prestigious literary magazine, published a rant about how Google was evil and hated publishers, and also how Google is like the Teletubbies.
What?
Yeah, it was kind of weird. But Teletubbies aside, the crux of the editor's argument seemed to be that when he searched for, quote, magazines that publish essays or, quote, magazines that publish short stories, Harper's website was not at the top of the list.
Okay, so it wasn't because Google had small televisions in their bellies.
No.
Okay. Well, so what? I mean, those are incredibly vague searches. I'm sure if I Googled podcasts that answer people's tech questions, I probably wouldn't find Deemable Tech in a hurry.
Exactly. Actually, if you search for magazines that publish essays, a small-time blogger who posted a list of magazines that publish essays is at the top of the results.
Right.
If you search for Google for Harper's Magazine, though, the top result is, guess what, Harper's webpage. And the next result is the Wikipedia entry for Harper's.
Okay, so it sounds like the moral of the story is that when you're Googling, be specific.
That's true. But while most people aren't as hopelessly clueless as the Harper's editor when it comes to Google, even tech-savvy folks are often not harnessing Google's full potential.
What do you mean?
Well, say you wanted to find out information about the phrase person of interest, but you're not looking for information on the TV show of the same name. How would you Google that?
Search for person of interest and go to page 10 of the results.
All right. Yeah, you'd probably have to dig through a lot of TV show stuff before you found out what you were looking for. But there's actually a much better way, and it's faster. The minus sign.
Oh.
When you're typing in a Google search, you can put a minus sign in front of words to exclude from the search. So if you Google person of interest minus TV minus show, the first result you'll get is a barbershop in Brooklyn with that name, and the second result is a Wikipedia page explaining what the phrase means. No digging through 10 pages of Jim Caviezel to find it.
Very cool. Well, I've got another Google pro tip for you.
Lay it on me.
Have you ever been on a website that had a search bar at the top, but it just didn't work very well?
Often.
Or maybe you wanted to search a website that had no search bar at all? Did you know that you can use Google to search inside any website?
Really?
Yeah, it's called site search. In the search box, you type site and a colon, and then the web address of the site that you want to search. No spaces. After that, you put a space and type the phrase you would like to search for within that site. So, for example, if I wanted to search Deemable Tech website for episode 12, I would just type site:deemable.com/episode/12.
Let me try it.
Okay.
Hey, that episode is in fact the first search result. Very nice.
Yeah, and you can use this trick to search deemable.com for any of the questions we've answered.
There's one more very cool Google search tool that I want to mention. Have you ever had an image and wanted to see where it came from?
Sometimes when I see someone post a picture on Facebook that I think might be fake, I wish I could do that. Like the pictures of sharks swimming in New York subway after Hurricane Sandy.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, you can search Google using images instead of text. Go to images.google.com, and now you'll see a camera icon on the right side of the search box. If you click it, you can give Google the web address of the image you want to search for, or you can upload an image from your hard drive to Google. Then Google will use its magical image matching software to find the most similar images it can. So you mentioned the sharks in the subway picture, Ray. Google image search is actually great for spotting fakes. If you've ever wondered if that beautiful woman who's trying to friend you on Facebook is for real, plug her picture in image search. And 10 to 1, that picture is of a professional model from somewhere. And if it is, Google image search will find it and pop it up for you.
Very cool.
Now, if you're interested in improving your Google foo, check out the article You Google Wrong by The Atlantic Wire, and we'll have a link to it in our show notes.
And also, Google actually offers an online course on power searching. Go to www.powersearchingwithgoogle.com. You can register for the class, which they run every couple of months, or you can just watch videos of a previous class. Even if you think you're pretty tech savvy, you can learn a lot.
That's a great idea. I'm going to send a letter to that editor from Harper's with that link.
Why not just email him, Tom?
I suspect he doesn't have email, Ray.
You might be right. Well, we do have an email. Let's see here. It's from David, and he writes, I'd like to charge my phone overnight while I am sleeping. It really only takes a couple of hours to charge the phone, so this worries me. I've heard that charging a battery too long can shorten its lifespan. Is that true?
Okay, good question, David. There is a lot of contradictory advice about batteries out there. The reason for this is not so much that people are trying to fool you, but there's just a lot of different types of batteries, and different types require different care. A similar thing that I had heard about batteries and believed was true is that if you unplugged them before they were finished charging, you would reduce their charging capacity.
Right.
That was pretty worrying for me because sometimes I need to grab my phone and go, whether it's done charging or not. Was I killing my battery? Well, fortunately, neither of us need to worry. Virtually all modern smartphones use lithium-ion batteries, or Li-ion batteries for short. These batteries are designed with the understanding that you're going to be using your cell phone on the go. Sometimes you'll need to unplug before you're finished charging, sometimes you'll plug the phone in for a quick top-off, and of course, you often leave it plugged in overnight. Li-ion batteries are designed for all these use cases. When charging at night, David, once your battery reaches full capacity, the phone will simply switch to using power directly from the outlet, so it's not going to overcharge it. It's also okay to recharge your battery before it runs all the way down. In fact, for Li-ion batteries, this is preferable. Maybe once a month or so, let your battery run all the way down before charging it, because this will help calibrate the battery. But most of the time, you do not need to do this. The truth is, the major threat to your battery life is just time. Rechargeable batteries have something known as charge cycles. A charge cycle is basically going from nearly empty to completely full. Every phone battery has a finite number of charge cycles. That number is very large. But eventually, your phone's battery will reach a point where its charging capacity starts getting smaller. Rechargeable batteries just don't last forever. You can help prolong your battery's lifespan by using fewer charge cycles. That means, of course, using less battery power. Conserve battery power by dimming your phone's screen, turning off 3G, 4G data when you have very few or no cell bars, and not playing too many games. Games tend to eat a battery like crazy.
Yeah.
When I'm at work, I usually leave my phone plugged in at my desk. With the battery fully charged, that means the battery isn't in use at all, which should extend the lifespan of the battery. Another thing that is bad for batteries, really bad for batteries, is heat. Using your cell phone in a hot environment can run down the battery really fast.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And of course, your phone can also heat up internally as well from intensive use, so you want to try to avoid that, or at least not to run apps that heat up your phone for too long. A cool phone is a happy phone.
That makes a lot of sense. My brother-in-law has a problem with his battery on his iPod Touch, and he plays a lot of intense graphic games. And so his iPod's hot all the time.
Yep, huh. That would do it.
Well, that's great, Tom. Now, here's something that I recently found out that's kind of related to this topic. Ever notice how when you plug in your phone, it seems to start to charge really fast, and then it takes forever to reach 100%?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that.
That's actually by design. Yeah. An iPhone battery, for instance, uses what's called fast charging to get the battery up to 80%. But then it switches to something called trickle charging. Both modes take about 2 hours to complete. So the last 20% of your phone charge will take just as long as the first 80%.
Huh. I did not know that. Now, it's important to keep in mind that we're talking about lithium-ion batteries here. Most cell phones, tablets, and laptops use lithium-ion batteries. but many other devices do not. So care for those devices may be different. These rules specifically apply to Li-ion batteries.
Okay. Well, we've got another email from Brandon. Can you grab that one?
Sure. Brandon asks, does it matter which order I unplug my computer in? For instance, if I want to move my laptop from the living room to my bedroom, but I want to keep Facebook open or keep playing Minecraft, should I unplug it from the wall first or should I unplug the cord from the laptop first? I think I saw a spark one time and it worried me that I could do some damage to my laptop if I'm not doing it right.
Yeah, good question, Brandon. It used to matter a lot because computers were really delicate, especially back in the 70s and 80s. Like, it was really a big deal. They weren't designed to stand up to any abuse, and they were really easy to break. It really doesn't matter as much now because most modern laptops have been designed to perform without problems, regardless of how you plug them in or unplug them. However, when you are plugging in and unplugging your computer from the wall, there is a chance that you could have an arc of electricity that can cause damage to your computer. It's rare, but it could happen, and it sounds like it has happened already in your case. So if you want to be safe, or you want to be really safe, when you unplug your computer, you should first remove the plug from your laptop, then remove the plug from your wall, and go in reverse order when you plug it back in.
So start at the wall when you're plugging something in, and start away from the wall when you are unplugging something.
Right. And it sounds almost counterintuitive, but yeah, when you're plugging in something, you want to start at the wall. When you're unplugging it, you want to start farthest away from the wall.
Gotcha.
Now, if you have a legitimate cause for concern, Brandon, such as a loose connector or a bad electrical outlet, you should also turn your laptop off first before you disconnect it, even if it does cost you points in the game. Obviously, though, you still need to get the problem fixed. You need to either hire an electrician to replace the outlet, or if it's the connector for your laptop, you can find a new connector for it online or at like a retail store like Radio Shack or Tiger Direct. If you don't fix whatever caused the spark, you may have a bigger problem on your hands than a bad score in Minecraft.
Yes, fire bad. Minecraft good, but fire bad.
And you know, I say that, I don't think that you have a score in Minecraft. I'm not sure about that.
Well, we'll wait for the hate mail to roll in and find out.
Yep. All right, we have an email from Mark. Mark writes, I just bought the movie The Adventures of Tintin.
Good movie.
Three discs came in the package, a DVD, a Blu-ray, and a 3D Blu-ray. I have a Blu-ray player and a 46-inch HD TV. I'm jealous. Is there a way to make the 3D version of, to play the 3D version of the movie? I assume I will also need 3D glasses. Can I get 3D glasses like they give you at the movie theater?
Hey, Mark, thanks for your question. So 3D is the new big thing in home video right now, right? And there are probably lots of people out there who have the same question. You have a nice big HDTV and a Blu-ray player, and you get one of these combo packs with a normal and a Blu-ray, and a normal and a 3D version of the movie in it on Blu-ray. Can you play the 3D version? The answer, unfortunately, is probably not. Playing 3D movies in the comfort of your own home takes more than just a 3D Blu-ray and a pair of 3D glasses you borrowed from the movie theater. To watch 3D movies, every single part of your home theater setup must be 3D compatible. You have to have a 3D source, like a digital cable channel that shows 3D, or your 3D Blu-ray of The Adventures of Tintin. Then your Blu-ray player has to be 3D compatible. Your TV has to be a 3D TV. And lastly, of course, you need 3D glasses covering your eyeballs.
Right. Now, but I do know that not just any old 3D glasses will do. You have to have 3D glasses that work with your specific model of 3D television.
That is true.
So what's the difference between them, Tom?
Okay, so there are two different types of 3D TVs, active and passive 3D. Despite the names, active is not more awesome than passive 3D. They're just different.
Is one like a sloth? The passive is like a sloth.
No.
And active is like a cheetah.
For an image to look 3D to you, the TV you are looking at has to send two different pictures to your eyes, right?
Okay.
One picture goes to your left eye, and the other picture is shifted ever so slightly over, and it's sent to your right eye. Mm-hmm. And that makes things look three-dimensional.
Right.
But if you both eyes see both pictures, the whole thing just looks fuzzy, and you'll get a headache trying to watch it.
Right.
So there's basically two different ways to achieve the effect of sending two different pictures to your separate eyes. Active 3D TVs first show one picture and then the other faster than the blink of an eye. And to make sure the right eye sees the right picture, you need active 3D glasses. And these glasses actually put a shutter over one eye for a fraction of a second so that only the other eye sees the image. And then they do the opposite. They switch it, putting the shutter over your first eye and then showing you the second image. Basically, active 3D glasses are blinking left, right, really fast. And to do that, of course, they need power, which is where the name active 3D comes from. So some of them you can just plug into a USB port to charge. Others take a small battery. Active 3D glasses also cost more. You might see them for upwards of $100, but don't pay that. You can get a perfectly good pair for around $20 if you check out Amazon.com.
Hmm.
Also, another consideration with active 3D glasses is you do need to pay attention to what type of method they use to sync with the TV.
Oh.
Older active 3D glasses and TVs used an infrared signal, but newer ones use a radio signal. So you got to make sure that you get the right active 3D glasses for your TV. Are you confused yet?
Yes.
Excellent. I haven't even talked about passive 3D. Fortunately, passive 3D is a lot simpler. The TV projects the two images at the same time, and one lens of your passive 3D glasses is polarized so that it filters out one picture, and the other is polarized so it filters out the other picture.
Interesting.
And this is the way they actually do it at the movie theater. So standard movie theater 3D glasses will, in fact, work with a passive 3D TV.
Oh, okay.
Now, the downside of passive 3D is that in order to cram two pictures into one, each eye is only seeing half the resolution of your TV.
Right.
But most modern HDTVs are so big and so high res that the human eye is really not going to notice this. If you have to have the best possible picture, you might go with active 3D, but the glasses do cost more, and some people complain that the shuttering effect, even though it's too fast for the naked human eye to spot, gives them headaches.
Right, and I imagine with my motion sickness and the...
Yeah, you might be more susceptible.
That might
too.
Not be good. I've never used one of the active ones. I've seen the passive ones. Okay, so to recap, to play 3D movies on your TV, you need a 3D Blu-ray disc, a 3D Blu-ray player, a 3D HD TV, and a pair of compatible 3D glasses, either active or passive, based on what your setup is.
Right. And all that means, sorry, your top-notch home theater system can't play 3D and won't be able to play 3D unless you swap out both the player and the TV. Now, the good news is that 3D TVs and Blu-ray players have really come down in price recently. I actually just picked one up and got a great deal. It's possible to pick one up for under $1,000 now. And 3D Blu-ray players cost just slightly more than their 2D counterparts. So you'll have to come over and... Mine's actually active 3D. You'll have to come over and check it out sometime and see if it gives you a headache, right?
Yeah, I'll have to see that. I mean, I know in 2011 or 12, the CES, it was just all about 3D TVs. And it seems like this year at the Consumer Electronics Show, it was less about 3D and more about, you know, 4K, the new ultra high definition.
Sure.
So they were less focused on that, you know, 3D as being the big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like 3D has actually become less important and people don't care about it as much. So from what you described, there's a lot that you have to do and change to get involved and not to get involved, but to be able to watch 3D movies. So is it worth getting into?
Well, one thing you'll find is that once you have a fully 3D compatible home theater system, the selection actually just isn't that great as far as the movies.
Mm.
You can't rent 3D movies either on Netflix or Redbox. You have to buy them, and they can cost more than double the price of a standard DVD. If you want to own the Avengers on 3D Blu-ray, you're going to pay out around $35.
Wow.
Yeah. So personally, if you have a nice standard HDTV and it has a good picture, I'd stick with it for now. I mean, 3D Blu-rays cost more. It's hard to find places that rent them. And only as many people as have 3D glasses can watch the movie. So, you know, you invite all your friends over to watch, you know, The Adventures of Tintin, and whoops, you only have two pairs of glasses. Only two of them can watch it.
So is there, you said that Netflix and Redbox right now don't stream 3D movies.
That's correct.
Is there anywhere that does?
Vudu does. The Vudu is the ultraviolet provider. They have some 3D movies. I haven't tried it out yet.
Yeah.
And there is a kind of a small-time operation that rents 3D TVs, but it's not Netflix, and I haven't tried it at all, so I can't vouch for it. I don't even remember the name.
Yeah, I know on YouTube you can, though. Have you tried those yet?
No, I haven't. There's YouTube 3D?
Yeah, there's a lot of YouTube 3D videos.
Yeah. Now, if you're looking to buy a new TV, keep your eyes peeled and see if you can't get a good deal on a 3D TV. But don't buy a TV just because it's 3D. For the foreseeable future, most shows and movies are going to be in 2D. Having a good 2D picture is much more important than having a 3D one.
All right, well, that's good information. Well, we have to take another quick break. When we come back, we have more of your questions. You're listening to Deemable Tech. Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange Homegrown Hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting. On the web at asmallorange.com.
Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Tom Braun, joined, of course, by my co-host, Ray Hollister.
Well, ask and you shall receive. I have been asking this for a long time, and the day is finally here. Okay, before I ruin it, let's jump into it. We have a debunkable today from Michelle. Do we have a stinger or a theme song for the debunkable segment yet?
Debunkable, bunkable, 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 debunkable, debunkable, bunkable, bunkable, bum bum.
Tom, did you just sing that?
Maybe.
Okay, so maybe we'll have Sean work on something for the debunkable segment, but can you read the debunkable for today?
Sure. Michelle writes, I received this email today. It sounds fishy. Is this legitimate? Okay, the email is from legalnotice@facebook.com, and the subject reads in all caps, Legal Notice of Settlement of Class Action.
Yeah, and it's a really long email, yeah, so we can kind of skim over it here.
Let's see. Notice of pending class action and notice of proposed settlement. You're receiving this email because you may have been featured in a, quote, sponsored story on Facebook prior to some date. A federal court authorized this notice. Let's see here. According to available records, you may be a class member.
What is the action about? That's an important line. The action claims that Facebook unlawfully used the names, profile pictures, photographs, likenesses, and identities of Facebook users in the United States to advertise or sell products and services through sponsored stories without obtaining the user's consent. Facebook denies any wrongdoing and any liability whatsoever. So it goes on. Let's see, what else does it have? Facebook will pay $20 million into a fund that can be used in part to pay claims of class members, including minor class members, who appeared in a sponsored story. Each participating class member who submits a valid and timely claim may be eligible to receive up to $10.
Ping, cha-ching. Going to Disney World.
Yeah, it says, let's see, if the number of claims made it renders it economically infeasible to pay money to persons who make a timely and valid claim, payment will be made to the not-for-profit organization identified on the settlement website at www.fraileyfacebooksettlement.com. Okay, so it goes on and on and on.
It's a freaking long email.
But it ends.
And the deadline is May 2, 2013.
Yeah, and it talks about the settlement or the class member numbers. The parents and guardians of children on Facebook, what they can do. And here's the thing.
Okay, so bottom line is this email says Facebook owes you $10.
Right, and you need to go to this website to register. And it breaks down what you need to do into different steps. Basically, you can participate in the class action lawsuit or exclude yourself from the class action lawsuit or not do anything.
Okay, so this is a really elaborate
scam.
And
you can object to it.
Oh.
To the class action lawsuit.
So this seems like a very elaborate scam.
Well, that's the thing. This is true.
What?
Yes. This was actually a real lawsuit. This really happened. And this long, in-depth email about it basically breaks down all the details of this case and the proposed settlement. So it hasn't been settled yet, but they are about to settle it.
Okay, so sponsored stories, those are those things where I don't know, Deemable Tech, let's say, for example, and then
right. On
somebody else's Facebook page, it's like, your friend, Tom Braun, liked Deemable Tech.
Exactly. And it'd have your picture next to it.
But they didn't ask me, right. You know? Like, they didn't come to me and say, hey, do you want to promote Deemable Tech? I clicked like somewhere at some point, not realizing I was signing up to advertise it.
Right, and back then, it was even worse, where it would happen automatically, you'd go to a website, and if you were logged into Facebook, boom, you liked their page.
Wow.
And that was, it happened with a fast food joint, and I found that out years later that I had liked it, and I didn't even really want to like it. I don't really like that place. I'm not going to mention them, but
that is a sleazy practice.
Yeah. So somebody sued, actually Angel Fraley sued Facebook, and they are settling out of court. Now, As it says on there, of course, Facebook is not accepting any liability. They didn't do anything wrong.
But they are paying $10 to anyone who asks.
Right. Maybe eligible for up to $10. Michelle did receive this in her email. And like I said, it came from legalnotices@facebookmail.com. And I think that's probably what made her suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. If you read through the entire letter, which it is really long, there are clues that it's legitimate. First off, it is a proper email address. Facebookmail.com is a legitimate Facebook
domain
that they send email from. It's actually the one that they use whenever they have to send an official email.
Okay.
And in the email, they provide documentation. They go through every single thing about this case, what's happening in the case, who the plaintiffs are,
yeah,
who the defendants are, what they have decided, and they tell you what you can do.
Mm-hmm. And there's contact information.
Yeah, and there's legitimate contact information. The Robert S. Arnes of the Arnes Law Firm, the phone number, the 1-888 number for the law firm, and also an email address at the law firm. And I checked those all out, and they all come up clean. They're all good.
Huh.
The website is a legitimate website that's legitimately set up by the law firm for this case. And also one thing that stood out really for me was there were clear deadlines for taking action.
Mm-hmm.
You have to respond by this date or you're going to lose out or
right.
You're not going to be part of it. But it wasn't like these, you know, swarmy threats or offers to get, you know, to get you to do it now.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, sales tactics. It was, you know, here's your options. You have till this date to choose one.
Yeah.
And honestly, the thing that really made it really obvious that this was correct and this was legitimate,
mm-hmm.
there was no bad English in it. There's no bad grammar. There's
yeah.
no misspelled words. I mean, this is a legal document
yeah.
that
yeah.
a law firm is sending out. And what we see in scams like this is usually they're just garbage.
For some reason, scammers can't spell.
They can't. Well, and it makes sense because, you know, I was talking to my wife about this before the show. The reason why is because most of the time they're not coming from within the United States.
Right.
They're coming from countries where English is a second or third language for mm-hmm. them. And because in the United States, you have the pressure of law enforcement agencies cracking down on you a little bit harder.
Right.
So, yeah, this is a legitimate case. So if you receive this email, here's what you need to do. Still check. Don't just click through the links because you don't know who this is coming from. And there have actually been scams based on this that mm-hmm. have started going out there. So make sure that you are going to the actual website, which is FraleyFacebookSettlement.com, and make sure that you're doing that. So check and make sure it's really coming from the correct email address and that the links are going to the place that you want to go,
mm-hmm.
not somewhere that some spammer is doing.
Right, and that's a good point, by the way. Sometimes you'll see in an email like a link highlighted in blue, underlined.
Yeah.
And it looks like a legit site, but if you actually hover over links, typically it will tell you the real address because that could not, in fact, be the real address the link is taking you to. So hover over it and make sure that the address, the hover address, matches the text address.
Or you can always just type the address into your browser.
True too. That's a good.
If there's any question about whether or not it's legitimate, mm-hmm. just type it in, and mm-hmm. it'll take you directly to it.
Now, Ray, you just mentioned that you had been featured in a sponsored story, so are you eligible for $10 from Facebook?
Well, I haven't received this email. My wife actually has, so I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to go to the website and check it out and see if I'm eligible for my $10.
Sweet. And what will you spend your $10 on?
I don't know. Probably an app. That's usually – or coffee.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have an email from William. You want to grab that?
Yeah. William asks, I love that the Kindle holds my furthest location, but my wife and I share one account. That makes things really annoying when she finishes the book and I'm just starting it. Is there a way to reset the synchronization or just turn it off?
Okay. So for our other listeners, let's explain what Kindle Whisper Sync is.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when you have multiple devices that are using Kindle, like a Kindle e-reader or maybe a Kindle Fire, an iPad, an iPhone, Kindle does something really great where it keeps you synchronized to whatever your last page was.
Right.
So, for instance, let's say you're reading your book at home and you put it down before you go to bed. And the next day you drive to work and you're at work on a break and you want to continue reading it. You open your iPhone and boom, you're on the page that you were at, even though you didn't do anything to adjust it on your iPhone.
I've done that, and it's great. I love that feature.
Yeah, it's really fantastic.
But I guess if you're sharing an account with someone and you're both trying to read the same book, well, it's like you're jumping around pages. And that would get pretty irritating, right, Ray?
Yeah, exactly, Tom. And I've experienced this with my wife. We have often read books together where we're both trying to read through the book and she'll get ahead or I'll get ahead. Mm-hmm. And then we'll open our iPhone or our iPad or the Kindle. And all of a sudden, we're lost. We have no idea where our page is. And it got really annoying because it just kept happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, William wants to know if this feature can be turned off. And I don't share an Amazon account with someone, so this has never been a problem for me personally. So have you and your wife figured out how to fix it, Ray?
Well, yeah. Like I said, it was getting to be really frustrating. It was happening all the time. And we trying to kind of worked around it by we kept a bookmark. But the thing is, you don't move your bookmark in an ebook. You just add another one.
Yeah.
So we ended up having a whole bunch of them, and we had to find the last bookmark that we made. But it is really easy to fix it and to turn this off. Here's what you do. Go to Amazon.com on your computer. You can't do it on your device. You have to do it on the computer. I guess you could do it on the browser, on the Kindle, but it would take a while.
Super slow.
Then go, like I said, go to Amazon.com, then click on your account. It's in the upper right-hand corner. Then click Manage Your Kindle, then Manage Your Devices, and then click Manage Kindle Device Synchronization.
Synchronization,
there you go. Now, under the heading Device Synchronization, and it also says Whisper Sync Settings, click Turn Off. And then wait a little while, maybe about 10 minutes. I tried it, and it didn't work within 5. It was like somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes. So wait a little while, then go back to your Kindle device or your Kindle app and exit the book and reopen it. Now, turn to the first page in the book and try to sync your book to the furthest position. It should say that you are at the furthest position if it worked correctly.
Ah.
Now, if you want to turn synchronization back on, just go back to Amazon.com and click Turn On under Device Synchronization. Unfortunately, there's no way to synchronize or unsynchronize just one of your books.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you don't move your position in any of your books while you have it turned off, when you reopen the book after you turn synchronization back on, they'll still be at the same position and will sync at that position with the servers.
You know, this is yet another device, and I think we were talking about this last week, where, you know, really there's a use case for more than one person using this device. Like we were talking last week about tablets, you know, how can I have two users on my iPhone, you know, or on my Samsung Galaxy Tab, and now my Kindle. And I think manufacturers and the software companies that make this stuff, they need to start thinking through this. Because obviously, you know, you and your wife share a Kindle, you and your wife share an iPad. You know, there's a lot of people doing that.
And even if we didn't share a Kindle, we'd want to share the same account.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we have to buy the same book twice.
Sure.
So I mean, I honestly think that similar to Apple, they just don't want us using the same account and using the same device.
That may be true.
So why would they accommodate that? So unfortunately, there's no easy fix. It would be great if there was just a user sign in and, you know, it would just save my current position and her current position separately. But until then, it's an easy fix to kind of go in there and change it. But you have to know where to find it. So it's your account, then manage your Kindle, then manage your devices, then manage Kindle device synchronization, and then click turn off under device synchronization.
Keep digging.
Yeah, it's easy to find, see? All right, we've got another email from Alana.
Yeah, she sent us an email with the great title, iMessage, I Ain't, I Working. She asks, I thought that when iOS 6 came out, iMessage was supposed to be synchronized between your iPad and your iPhone. I have an iPad and an iPhone, and my husband has an iPhone, but he has to send text to either my iPad or iPhone. Mm. It doesn't work on both. Did I read that wrong, or do I have something set up wrong?
Well, iOS 6 did fix the problem, but it didn't fix it automatically.
Okay, so first of all, for our listeners that don't have iOS devices, iMessage is a text messaging system that works on iPhones, iPads, and iPod Touches. And it replaces text messaging for folks using those devices. So the great thing is that iMessage texts don't use your texting plan, but they go onto your data plan instead.
Right. The problem was that you had to keep track of which device you were messaging.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I could send a message to my wife's iPhone or her iPad, but not to both at the same time. And to make things worse, iMessage would show the message based on who sent it, not which device sent it. So I would have two message threads that both had my wife's name on them. It was really frustrating, and there wasn't anything we could do about it. The problem is that on an iPhone, it used to be that you signed into iMessage with your iPhone, and that was it. You couldn't sign in with an email address. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, on the iPad and the iPod Touch, you signed in with your email address. You couldn't mm-hmm. sign in with your phone number. Then iOS 6 came out, and you could sign into iMessage on any device with multiple sign-ins, including additional email addresses, which was nice because mm-hmm. you didn't have to use the email address you used for your Apple account, which kind of was irritating for me because I use a special email address just for that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could use your phone number on any device. So that was supposed to fix the problem. Now, all of your iMessage would appear on all of your devices.
Oh, great.
Except it didn't just work, like they say Apple products do. And everyone that I've talked to that has multiple iDevices has dealt with this. But fortunately, it is a fairly easy thing to fix.
Okay, Ray, so what do we do to fix it?
Well, if you want to sync your iDevices across iMessage, open the iSettings, I'm just kidding, just open the Settings app on all of your devices. So get them all out and open them all up and go to Messages and tap Send and Receive. Then scroll down to the heading that reads Start New Conversation From and make sure that whatever sign-in you're using for that, it is the same sign-in across devices.
So it's going to be the same sign-in on your iPhone, your iPad, your
exactly.
iPod Touch, whatever.
Exactly. Now, if you do have an iPhone, I would suggest using your iPhone's number for simplicity's sake. But otherwise, you know, just make sure you're using the same email address across them all.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I made the assumption that you're using the same Apple ID on both devices, but just to be safe, check and make sure that you are. The Apple ID is at the top of that page, and it's got to be the same on both devices or all of your devices. If it's not, tap on the Apple ID and sign out, and then sign in to the same address on both. Also, under the heading you can be reached by iMessage at, make sure that you have all of the same email addresses and phone numbers listed. You know, if you're missing a phone number or email address on the list of one of those devices, you need to make them match. Either delete it from the device that has it or add it to the device that doesn't. Then you should be good. Test it out.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, Ray, do we have any apps we want to talk about this week?
Yeah, I do. There's a couple of apps that I have been playing with last week. One's called App Gratis.
Okay.
And the other one is Apps Gone Free.
All right.
And it's really simple. They are apps that tell you what apps are free.
Oh.
Now, there's a lot of free apps out there, but these are specifically apps that normally cost money, and they're giving them away for free for the day.
Very nice.
So App Gratis will actually contact the app developers and ask them to put it on sale for free for the day, whereas Apps Gone Free basically just lists all the apps that are out there that normally cost money that are free for the day. And I've been trying out a lot of new apps that I haven't before.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's been kind of frustrating is that I have been finding a lot of apps that I've already paid money for.
Oh.
So I could have saved over $20 already if I'd had this app before. So well, I don't know if it's on Android also, but it's great on iPhone.
Okay, I'm going to look for that then.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for all your questions and keep them coming. Call us at our toll-free number, 1-888-972-9868. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com. Also, subscribe to the show. Search for Deemable Tech on iTunes or point your favorite podcast app to dmbl.co/pod. Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I am Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange, homegrown hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting, on the web at asmallorange.com. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Tom Broad.
Oh.
Joined, of course, by my co-host.
Didn't realize I was so sexy and dangerous when I spoke.
Did you just call me sexy and dangerous?
Well, that was like the sexy and dangerous. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. It's like, or at least the action movie voice.
I need more questions because
I need more sexy and dangerous in my headphones, Sean.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, that was it.
Happy New Year.
I think that should be the stinger for today.
Happy New Year.
But have me say, can I have more? Yeah. Oh, gosh. I think we were losing Ray. do you need a minute?
I do need a minute.
I'm going to get a drink of water.
Okay.